Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And on the phone we have Eva Golinger, author of The Chavez Code and Bush versus Chavez and Washington's War on Venezuela, which came out last year. So Eva, I know I sort of cut you at the end, but I definitely wanted to get, you know, there's a lot to be talked about. I think obviously, you know, I was in Venezuela both last January and then last November, we got a chance to meet each other, and it was totally a moving moment for myself, even though I had been following in from very far away the process in Venezuela, and obviously it was very clear in my mind that when I heard about the coup, and obviously subsequently seeing, you know, the revolution will not be televised, which is, in many ways, even though it's had very limited release here in the U.S., it's sort of pirated through different circles and families, so people have been seeing it, and you could clearly see sort of the role of, in some ways, you could, even though they don't really talk about the role of the U.S., you can clearly see that a lot of it's been revolved around it. How has it been being in Venezuela? And as you said, you know, in many ways, the book has been able to sort of shift some consciousness around, from some ways, from what I understood from being there, relatively harmonious relationships with the U.S. because obviously most of the governments in the past had been very pro the U.S. and had much given the U.S. sort of a favorite nation status, both by either through force or through cooperation, but didn't matter. The U.S. had a lot of influence over Venezuela. Even as I saw in the Chavez Code, Venezuela's role even inside the process to destabilize the government of the Sandinistas. So how do you see the hope of what Venezuela is trying to do in Latin America and throughout the world, and how do you think, and where do you think the U.S., how has the U.S. been weakened from that work, that important work that Chavez and the revolution has been doing throughout Latin America?
Well, I definitely think that, and part of why I've chosen to go back and live in Venezuela since 2005, full-time, and I'm proud to live there and wouldn't live anywhere else right now, is primarily because I think what's happening in Venezuela with the revolution is probably the most inspirational and extraordinary social movement of modern times. I lived in Venezuela back in the 90s before Chavez. Mm. I saw how the country was run, how repressive it was, how apathetic and disconnected people felt from their government, from politics and economics and the future of their country, very similar to how the U.S. is in many ways on a, you know, a widespread level, how impotent people felt, how much people felt that, well, one person doesn't make a difference, why vote? I mean, things very similar to those that I experienced living in the United States and frustration, mm-hmm, of being basically helpless to change your country. I mean, that's how Venezuelans felt before Chavez. And so I've lived through, and also living in a very repressive state at that time, I mean, incredibly repressive, where constitutional rights were suspended constantly by the prior regimes before Chavez. Curfews were imposed on a national scale. Police and National Guard were used to detain people arbitrarily all the time. There was even a military draft, which is completely ridiculous, was in Venezuela. You know, there was no reason to have that. And so those are all things that were done away with during Chavez. We've never had a suspension of constitutional guarantees, never had a curfew. The draft was immediately eliminated, and I mean, there's just widespread participatory democracy and freedom from repression. And to live through that transformation, to see now Venezuelans, your average Venezuelan in any class status, but primarily people who are marginalized and excluded from political life, who are now so active, so motivated, so impassioned about being able to change their country. Not just watching it from afar, but being actually a part of it. and that people stand in line for 10 hours if they have to just to exercise their right to vote. Mm-hmm. I commented, I remember, to a friend who was visiting from the U.S. Caracas during the December presidential elections last year that, you know, people are partying. They're actually having parties the night before voting to celebrate the fact that elections are going to be held the next day. Mm-hmm. So they're so excited about the political process in the country and how unimaginable that probably is for people in the United States, especially with the administration that's been in power here now for 7 years or 6 years. So I think that in many ways Venezuela provides that inspiration on sort of a social level, that change is possible, that you can also change, transform your nation from a capitalist, consumerist type society, which Venezuela was before, which still is, because, you know, we're still in a process of transformation, but to one that's more socially oriented, to create new values that are based on community ideals in the sense that people are put before profits. I mean, some of the very sort of cheesy concepts that you could classify in that way, I don't mean to use that terminology, but sometimes in the U.S. people become so cynical that that's how it's viewed. But that's the reality we're living in Venezuela. We actually have a president and a whole government in place that is leading those efforts, promoting those efforts together with the people. I mean, now what's happening is, you know, the Chavez has put forth some new ideas to sort of, you know, deepen or transform the country even further into a broader type of revolution that is being constructed and developed in Venezuela, that will eventually hand over most power to the people, communal power, community-based power, even talking about handling state budgets and things like that, you know, from the government type of federal budgets, putting it into the hands of communities so they can administer their own funds for their own needs because they're the ones who best know what their community needs or what the region needs, those types of things. I mean, really interesting concepts of different ideals that are occurring right now in Venezuela. So it's a hope in many of those ways. And then again, also, you know, that Venezuela has been so successful under the leadership of Chavez in breaking U.S. domination in Latin America, you know, stopping it in many cases, particularly in South America. I mean, that Venezuela has been able to help other countries because of its massive profits from the oil industry, countries like Argentina, countries like Bolivia, now Ecuador more so, not completely yet, but, you know, on the way to free themselves from debt, international debt under World Bank and International Monetary Fund that has crippled their economies anyway and pushed them further into poverty. And Venezuela's helping countries to liberate themselves from that debt, not by imposing more debt, but by creating, again, like I was saying before, this new model of integration of cooperative type of international trade, not just on an economic level, but also on a social and cultural level. So I think that type of new model is also very inspirational, that we can have a different type of globalization, true globalization in the sense that we live in a global community,
right,
but make it a community.
As we say in the center, well, it's not really us, probably Lenin Center or some other, you know, more important leftist than us, but that in some ways this process has to, global integration has to be, you know, by common bond, not through forced integration as the U.S. attempts to do through many of its agreements. I've been reading a lot of your writing, and it seems really scary, a lot of the stuff now that the U.S. is attempting to put through its mouth heads, the L.A. Times, the New York Times, the Miami Herald. Now, not only is Chavez obviously doing something as bad as trying to feed the poor and integrate people into one whole hole to be able to compete against the U.S., now there's a whole set of things being said about the Chavez and Venezuela. Everything from now, they're going to help the drug trade in the world because of either agreements that Chavez has refused, given some of the conditions that the U.S. has attempted to put, or now, you know, even the call for national security through, like, enforcing the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, as, again, sort of find some way to say, oh, can you please throw Venezuela there now because they're also a dangerous threat to the U.S.
Right.
It must be, I mean, in some ways, I think your work is very important because I think it's reaching a lot of people, and I know a lot of circles know it. But I guess in some ways, I mean, this is my sort of own guilt in some ways, is like, what what are the moves that we need to do here in the U.S.? Because it seems that, as I said before earlier, before we went to the break, that El Salvador and Nicaragua did have a movement that was very powerful and was able to shape, in some ways, public debate in a different way than at this current moment. And I guess I'd like to see what has your work out here in the U.S. when you come out here, what has been the reception, and what are moves by anybody to call, can we call? I know there's going to be some important, very important mobilizations in 2 weeks from now here in Los Angeles and New York to call for hands off Venezuela and Cuba and Bolivia. But beyond that, is there any, you know, sort of integrated campaign to sort of be able to stop the attacks against Venezuela?
One of the most obviously important ways, or first steps, in fact, to take to combat this type of U.S. intervention, which is increasing in terms of its aggression, hostility towards Venezuela, is very scary, very frightening, considering, you know, what this particular administration has done so far, but also what U.S. government has done throughout history in Latin America. Invasions, interventions, coups, assassinations, all kinds of things. You know, one of the most important things, obviously, is getting the information out there about what's happening. Now, you know, some people may say, that's not enough, but that's huge, because obviously the more you combat the misinformation or the disinformation, which in the case of Venezuela is massive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. is conducting and in connection or in collaboration with major media in the United States, which we all know has corporate interest that is basically, you know, in a lot of cases, particularly in the case of Venezuela, a voice for U.S. government policy. And, you know, there's this ongoing media war against Venezuela, psychological warfare. What you're reading in the papers here, what you're seeing on CNN or Fox or now even sometimes your local news about Venezuela is generally distorted, manipulated information, sometimes outright lies, with the goal, obviously, of trying to convince the U.S. public that any type of intervention or action against Venezuela will be justified because, according to the Department of State and according to the New York Times or the L.A. Times, Chavez is a ruthless dictator who's repressing his people and, you know, needs to be removed as soon as possible. And, I mean, that's the impression you get, when in reality, that's not what's happening at all. We've got a flourishing participatory democracy, you know, with a leader, a government that's been elected by more than 63% of its people, not something that the government in the U.S. could claim, you know, and an incredible social movement, inspirational, and is, you know, a government together with the people that has eradicated illiteracy just over a four-year period. You know, created, built new medical clinics and hospitals providing medical attention, not just, you know, basic attention, but high-level technological interventions, operations, you know, all kinds of diagnostic treatment centers that have been built, everything for free. Job training, more than 14,000 cooperatives that have been created just over the past couple of years to try to create a more sort of economically productive social model in the country with more smaller and medium-sized businesses rather than large corporations, and obviously making them Venezuelan or having more be Venezuelan investments national level. So, you know, here we've got this is what's taking place in reality in Venezuela with a flourishing media and a flourishing opposition, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
No political prisoners, none of that. And what you're reading in the U.S. media is the opposite. So I think, for one, the important thing is to get the accurate information out there, combat the lies, and call them on it, too. Not let them get away with it. The papers, the newscasters, and the State Department or White House spokespeople, whoever it is. Next step, obviously, one of the major areas where people in the U.S. can take action on is the fact that U.S. taxpayer dollars are being used in the millions, not just in Venezuela and other countries, but particularly in this case, through the National Endowment for Democracy and the State Department's USAID to fund ongoing efforts of the Venezuelan opposition to destabilize the country. Now, this is really well documented in both my books, and Venezuela provides sort of a case example of how the funds have been misused.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way where people can take action on to call on Congress, which is the entity that is constantly approving the increase in funding to all these groups in Venezuela, to stop the funding. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. I mean, the Democrats love the National Endowment for Democracy, so it's not a partisan issue. But the more folks are out there, I mean, I really think, you know, as apathetic or as frustrated as people can be in the U.S., that a movement, a really powerful, unified movement is what's necessary, mass mobilization, you know, even in the streets. I mean, the same in the case of the Iraq War. You know, people say, oh, well, that marching and all that kind of stuff. But, hey, that's how in many ways we've done it in Venezuela and continue to do. You've got to get people motivated and make them impassioned and feel a part of something in order to bring about change. And so I think the financing issue is a huge one where mobilization can be done in a way that's also to unify different groups that maybe don't get along right now in the United States around this issue of U.S. intervention in Venezuela or in other countries around the world. Not, again, use your money to be doing this. To use U.S. taxpayer dollars, hard-earned dollars of poor people, working-class people, middle-class people, and even upper-class people in the United States to try and destabilize and overthrow governments that have been happily elected by their people and are trying to just pursue their own type of democracy. And then, of course, obviously, is to try to combat U.S. militarism in the region. The increase, even though people say, oh, no, the U.S. is tied up in Iraq and Afghanistan, well, that's not necessarily 100% accurate. I mean, the U.S. has been increasing its military presence in Latin America, trying to, in fact, build new bases, new military bases that are costing big, big bucks. So I think there need to be also efforts in that sense. And obviously, other efforts to create solidarity on a sort of pueblo-to-pueblo or person-to-person, community-to-community type of basis from the U.S. directly to communities and peoples in Venezuela. I think that would be a really enriching experience. I know it's already being done in some different movements and communities, Hands Off Venezuela being one of them, Venezuela Solidarity Network, U.S. Cuba Labor Exchange. I mean, there are different movements. Personally, I think we don't have time anymore for division. Really, these organizations need to get unified to build one movement. Doesn't mean it has to have one perspective or everyone has to agree on everything. It's just that the more divided groups are, and I think that's what has happened a lot to social movements in the U.S., after all the COINTELPRO counterintelligence efforts from the 60s and 70s that were purposely directed at dividing the social movements in the U.S. and destroying them, infiltrating them. But I think that it's time that we get back together because the world is in a crisis. I mean, there's massive war taking place that's now being expanded, possibly to Iran, Venezuela included, Cuba, another nation. And I think that, you know, the people of the U.S., with all the divisions and all the apathy and the frustration, are becoming a part of the problem, and that has got to change because the peoples around the world are getting more and more unified. Venezuela is getting together with Argentina, with Colombia, with the people of Bolivia, Cuba, people in Belarus, in Russia, or wherever, in Iran, are getting together to create a united front against imperialism. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that people in the U.S. take that into account and try to make the effort to do the same.
Well, that's some beautiful words, Eva. I know that you have to go, and I know you have prior events. I mean, again, you know, this, we've been talking to Eva Golinger, you know, author of The Chavez Code and author of Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. And I think that's why we want to have you here, and that's why we've invited you here. And I really hope that people come out and support the event. It's going to be on Thursday night, and it's going to be at 7 p.m. at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. It's 3300 Wilshire Boulevard. We're going to have Eva Golinger with myself and Eric Mann. We met Eva out there in Venezuela, and obviously we were part of, as you were saying, the celebration for people going out, being dancing reggaeton before even the day of the elections was just a moving thing, and fireworks, and just the celebratory and yet sort of like real responsibility people felt toward the government and the changes that is trying to take place was just a very moving place. And as you were saying, we are very dedicated to building this broad united front against imperialism, and we do want to be able to create sort of a body inside the United States to say we reject this government and the government and what it's attempting to do to the world. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to, you know, further these conversations, and I guess we'll see ourselves on Thursday at evening.
Definitely. And well, first of all, thanks so much, Memal, for the time that you've dedicated to the interview, for giving me the space to talk about this. And I'm really excited about the event with the Strategy Center on Thursday. I hope people will come out. I will have books for sale,
right,
both books, The Chavez Code and Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela, in English, The Chavez Code in English and Spanish, and Bush versus Chavez is actually only available right now in Spanish. But I would come out and get it because there are limited copies, and obviously it's unattainable in the United States. So I hope people will come. The books are really good sources of information and are basically weapons in the war against U.S. imperialism internationally. And I look forward to being out there and to talking and hearing what people have to say about the issue. So thanks for that.
Thank you, Eva.
Okay.
So, folks, you know, that was Eva Golinger, and I'm getting here like a little improv sort of time here. Basically, you know, as everybody knows, I'm an organizer of the Bus Riders Union, the Strategy Center, and we have just gotten word this past weekend about a set of fare increases that the Metropolitan Transportation Authority is attempting to push on bus riders and transit riders throughout the city of Los Angeles. The punitive aspect of these prices is just going to drop your jaw for people who have not heard, but essentially MTA CEO Roger Schnoble is calling for a set of fare increases, one that would start for July 2007, which would basically impact immediately, and then it's sort of a two-prong fare increase proposal for another one that would then begin on January 2009. For folks who don't ride the buses, everybody knows that bus riders are 90% people of color, over 60% of them who make less than $12,000 a year, 60% women. They are the poorest of the poor of the region. And MTA CEO Roger Schnoble has essentially now opened up in public the information on how much he wants to raise fares. And obviously this doesn't automatically happen, but obviously for him to move forward on a call for proposal must mean that he has a lot of support inside the board to move forward on fare increases. So let me give you the prices. So for people who ride the bus currently, know that for a day pass, which is a pass that you can carry the whole day for 24 hours, would go essentially from the current $3 to $5 in 2007, in July of 2007. In January 2009, would go up to $8. The monthly bus pass, which was one of the key victories that we won against MTA back in our initial struggles back in 1994, when MTA called for the elimination of that bus pass and voted in favor of eliminating that bus pass. Now, essentially, they're not saying we're eliminating, but for all intents and purposes, are moving on on raising the bus pass from the current $52 to $75 in July of this year. And then in January of 2009, would go up to $120. Bi-weekly pass, which for a lot of folks who in the beginning of the month don't have enough money to buy themselves, you know, a monthly bus pass because of the rent and all the other costs that you have in your life, they essentially would call for the elimination of this call. We urge everybody to join us tomorrow at the corner of Western and Wilshire. We're making a call to Mayor Villaraigosa and his three appointees on the MTA board, on MTA chair Gloria Molina, to withdraw this very racist, punitive fare increase. So I hope people can join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. at the corner of Western and Wilshire at our press conference. So that's it for today's show. I mean, I'd like to thank, obviously, Eva Golinger. You've been listening to Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Manuel Criollo. And we had music from Los Guarawaos, Iraquere, and the OJs, as you're listening to now. I'd like to remind folks to come out to Thursday, 7 p.m. at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church to our program, Venezuela and the Responsibility of the U.S. Left, at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 33300 Wilshire Boulevard. We would like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, production assistant, Lisa Adler, and our engineer, Maggie LaPeak. And we'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.